Hello. Welcome to another episode of The Telltale Heart, a Cardiovascular Digest of Pharmacists. And we're excited to bring you another episode. And this is going to be clinical, but in a different sense. Like, we've done this before, and I've always advocated, I've always wanted to continue to get patient perspectives on this. And so I'm excited to have my guest today, who will introduce herself shortly. Her name is Rhonda Monroe. She is also part of Heart Life. And if you remember a couple episodes back, we had Mark Baines, one of the other co-founders or leaders in this organization, talk about his journey and in the value of pharmacists and what he wished people would appreciate and understand from the patient perspective. And I definitely want to introduce and share Rhonda. She has such an incredible journey, and it has so many, when she told me, poignant things to think about as a clinician and about providing, you know, real care and continuation with the patient and having them as a part of the team and valuing them as a part of the team. And then, you know, looking at what the pharmacist can do from that standpoint. So Rhonda, I'm excited to have you on the show, and I definitely got to meet you at ACC this past year. So Rhonda, tell me and introduce yourself, you know, how you want to introduce yourself, and then maybe we can jump in.
Great. Thank you so much for having me on the show, Craig. I'm really excited to be here. As you said, my name is Rhonda Monroe, and I am a heart failure survivor. I'm a heart attack survivor, three-time heart attack survivor, a stroke survivor, and now an advocate for heart patients globally. My journey actually began 22 years ago, nearly 22 mm-hmm. years ago. And I was 5 days postpartum. I was nursing my daughter, who just graduated from Duke University.
Yes, congratulations, yay, right? Woo-hoo. That was this past weekend, right? So,
yes. And so I was nursing her, and I put her in the cradle because I felt crushing substernal chest pain. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, I'm having a heart attack. And then I looked in the mirror and I said, no, I'm too young to have a heart attack. But then the elephant that was sitting on my chest continued to waddle and press into the center of my chest, and yeah. I relented. I am having a heart attack. And really, that's where my journey began. And from there, I called 911. I went to the hospital by ambulance. The EMTs did their standard cardiac protocol with an EKG, which indicated that I was having an acute myocardial infarction. I was sinus brady, had abnormal T waves. And when I got to the ER, I was misdiagnosed. I was observed and then discharged with a ridiculous diagnosis. And that went on for an entire week, Craig.
So let me ask you this. So you're like, I think I'm having a heart attack. And yes, you actually did what a lot of people don't do, which is actually react and come into the hospital, right? Because you clearly recognize that even though you're at first like, I'm too young for this, you're like, something's not right. And you come into the hospital. And you know, because there are a lot of people, and I think that's one of the first points that I always encourage people not to ignore symptoms. And you definitely did not do that, for sure.
I didn't. Well, let me say the symptoms actually began the day before with in my left arm.
Mm-hmm.
And that I kind of attributed to, you know, maybe I'm doing too much because I had not finalized the nursery prior mm-hmm. to going into the hospital. And so I was up and about, you know, trying to get things done just to put the finishing touches on. And I said, you know, maybe I'm doing too much. Maybe I should take it easy. And so I stopped for the day. But the next day, it came back with a vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I acted. And that's when I went to the hospital.
Yeah. And so you get there and, you know, they do the standard workup, like you're saying. But then, so are you able to share what diagnosis they did give you? And
I did.
Yeah.
I'll just give you all of them. I was initially diagnosed with a slipped disc, indigestion, Well, first, a slipped disc, indigestion, and then the third time said that I was a hysterical new mother, although I was not hysterical. And the clinical notes that I retrieved later referred to me as stoic, and I'm talented, but I can't be hysterical and stoic at the same time. I haven't yet mastered that skill. And so, and so it was ridiculous because I was also not a new mother. This was my third child. And so I had even though every pregnancy is different, you know your body, you know that something's wrong. And so I just would not relent. You know, I just kept going back. They would send me home, and that went on for 7 days, Craig. Unfortunately, time is muscle, and so my heart had become severely damaged by the time I got to the cath lab. So on that seventh day, I was made to wait 2 hours. I was greeted with an "Oh, you again?" And I was like, "I'm dying and I need help and I can't help myself." And I was made to wait 2 hours. And after 2 hours, I was called back to triage. And the triage nurse said to me, "Well, based on what you're telling me, I'm going to send you back to the cardiac care area." And I looked perplexed. I had been there many times during the week, and I had never even made it to the cardiac care area in the ER. And so when I get back to the cardiac care area, they proceed to do the people on duty that day, the nurses, they did their protocol, their workup, and literally all hell broke loose.
So, can I ask another question? Sorry to jump back. When your first presentation, did they do an ECG and just said, well, that wasn't, there was nothing there, or
They
did you know?
said I had an abnormal baseline. I have no history of heart disease. This is not an abnormal baseline, but they dismissed me. The EKG that was done en route to the hospital said acute myocardial infarction, sinus brady, inverted T waves. I had inverted T, and they still ignored me and said, "We don't think you're having a heart attack."
Bless your heart. So then you like you said, you're coming back, they put you in the cardiac care area, and then what happens?
So in the literally all the bells and whistles, then all hell breaks loose. It's, "Oh my God, emergency." And they call it, they're making the calls for stat and this and that, and the serendipitously, I guess. The doctor who had been on call all week and very dismissive, and just a couple days prior, I had asked him to come back in because I said, "Look, I know that something is wrong. Please send the doctor back in." And he refused to even come back in to see me. This same doctor is on duty, and he comes back in and he has to face me now. And he says, "Young lady, I'm glad you were persistent. You were right. You are having a heart attack. And now we've got to transfer you downtown to save your life."
Well, at
And
least
I said,
they
"Big
acknowledged it
dummy."
at some point, right? But man.
I did. I said, "You big dummy. I've been having a heart attack all week. I'm not a doctor, but I'm educated, I'm articulate, I have 3 degrees, and I'm an expert on Rhonda."
Yeah, you are. I mean, you're an expert on your body for sure. Like you, and I think that's one of the messages when I talked to you about this that really resonated with me when you presented the story to ACC is I think a lot of, not everybody does this, and I don't want to lump your the people engaged in your care into this, but I think sometimes, and this is not to excuse anybody's actions, so I don't want to say it this way either. But sometimes you get into a routine of things, or you may not, especially depending on the people and how they present, you're just sometimes you forget that everybody's individualized, and to your point, the patient knows themselves the best, and you have to remember to always engage them in that. And I think that's something that I've definitely always learned in my life, but definitely something that resonates. And your case is a great example
So let me be
of
candid.
that.
And one of
Yeah.
the reasons, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but
And no, you're pleased. Absolutely. This is your story. So.
one of the reasons that I became an advocate is because, and particularly now in the research arena, is the reason I was dismissed. Healthcare disparities exist. I don't care how we want to pretend
Exactly.
they
Yeah.
don't. Healthcare disparities exist. And I walked in a young African American woman instead of a middle-aged white guy. And that is the thought, and research had only been done really in this population. And so that's who they were looking for with my symptoms.
Right.
And so because I didn't show up in a way that they expected, they kind of rationalized it away. And so I think it's important, one, that we recognize that anyone can have a heart attack. You know, and we see in today's society that people are having heart attacks younger and younger. And not heart disease is not just a man's disease, it's also a woman's disease.
Sure, absolutely.
Many women have heart attacks. People of color have heart attacks. And so it's really important that we level the playing field, if you will, especially in the research pipeline, so that there is evidence that says, empirical evidence that says, these are the signs and symptoms of a heart attack. These are the treatments for a heart attack, and those treatments have been tested in a population that's reflective of society so that the results are truly generalizable.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I think that that's my secondary message that I was going to get to, and I think that you've cut to the chase, and I think that's where we've got to continue to advocate and do always do better for all the populations and subpopulations, both in generating evidence and understanding that, but also really reminding ourselves in the process of identification and treatment and pulling the systems of care together to take any of that evidence or take what's available or not to exclude people as a part of this process and really be more deliberate. And I don't know if that's the best word, but just to
Intentional.
intentional about the way that we care and look for everybody. And you know, it's a journey you have to continually think about regularly is you know, how to make sure that you're always thinking about equity and processes and really caring for everybody as broadly and nuanced as able, but to really make sure that you're really taking each patient, applying some of the same standards, not discrediting individuals, doing the due diligence, and then obviously we obviously can continue to improve with data and research and outcomes. I know they're continually trying to enroll, you know, more and more diverse populations in studies to understand and have outcomes from that standpoint. So I definitely echo and agree with your message on that standpoint. But I think from a day-to-day point is really, like you said, being intentional and like I was alluding to, having the patient be a part of that journey and not discrediting them and really looking at the patient as a whole and the person they are and what they're presenting with and valuing that they know Rhonda, right? They're an expert in
Exactly.
Rhonda,
Exactly.
right?
I know
Yeah.
myself. And so I think my case is the perfect example of, had you listened to not just the patient, but to the signs, the symptoms, and the science, you would have come to the right conclusion a lot earlier. And
Right.
we're all human. We all see life through our own perspective and past experiences. But in medicine, we really have to, I mean, if an EKG says they're having a heart attack, you probably should kind of take that to heart.
Sure. No, right. Yeah, absolutely. So you end up getting, same doctor saying, "Oh, I think you're right. You had a heart attack." What happens? What happens next
Oh,
for
he actually, he
Rhonda?
said, "You were right. I'm glad you
Yeah,
were
right.
persistent."
Yeah,
Right.
exactly.
He said, "I'm glad you were persistent. You were right." And so, I'm rushed to the larger hospital in the system, and taken to the cath lab. 5 coronary artery dissections, left
Oh
main
gosh.
LAD, circumflex right coronary, and a diagonal. And then I'm rushed to the OR, and I have a quadruple bypass. I
A lot,
wait.
and this is just to remind people, you had just had a baby, right? How long
Yes.
ago?
And now it's been a week.
A
We're on
week.
like day, no, longer than, it's been a week. I was 5 days postpartum,
Yeah.
and
But
then
still,
went through
2 weeks from delivery almost,
seven
right? Or
days,
within,
right? So we're
yeah.
like day 12 now from delivery, and almost 2 weeks out. And I have quadruple bypass surgery. I'm still nursing my daughter at this point. And in between my ER visits, I'm still nursing her. And so we are I have an emergency quadruple bypass, and I'm recovering, and I wake up the next morning in recovery, Craig, and I'm intubated, and I motion to the nurse to take the tubing out. And she's like, "Why?" And I'm like trying to tell her, I'm pointing to my heart. And she takes it out, and I said, "I think I'm having another heart attack."
Oh my gosh.
True story. And she's like, "Are you serious?" And I said, "Yeah." And she's like, "Okay." So she calls for EKG, right? And I'm in ICU. And she calls for an EKG. And sure enough, I was having another heart attack. And so they bring in the doctor on call. And he's the biggest risk taker in the system. And he's like, "Literally nothing we can do."
You just had bypass surgery, right?
Yes. Like less than 24 hours ago. So they alternate pumping blood and plasma, blood and plasma, until my heart stabilizes. And then I stabilize, and I'm finally released, and I'm home, and I'm like, "Oh my gosh, something else is wrong." So I go back to the doctor, and I have Dressler syndrome
Oh my gosh.
and pericarditis. It just went on and on, and I battled with recurrent pericarditis for a year, and so I was super excited to see a therapy come to market
Hopefully.
in recent
Yeah.
years, because all that was available for me was steroids and colchicine. And so and then I was relatively stable for about a month or two, and then I developed arrhythmias. And then I had an ICD placed, got infected, developed a hematoma, had to be evacuated, ended up in a hospital for a month.
And
And
during this whole time, you had also a reduced ejection fraction because you essentially had periparticular cardiomyopathy, right?
I did, but
Yeah.
not at this point. I get to, I'm still relatively normal.
Oh, so you didn't have
So
periparticular
it was,
cardiomyopathy, but you had, despite all your events, you still had a normal ejection fraction.
I did lower,
Okay. Lower,
but
okay.
normal. And I developed the arrhythmias, and I had the AICD placed and all the stuff after that. And then I go through cardiac rehab. And on the next to last cardiac rehab session, I begin to experience chest pain again.
Oh gosh.
And so I call the doctor, and I'm like, "I have chest pain." And so cardiac rehab was like 3 months, as or close to it. And so this is now January because of Christmas holiday. I had a couple, in September I had the AICD, but I didn't because of the holiday, I wasn't finishing my cardiac rehab until January. And she says, well, pack a bag when you come for your next visit and I'll put you in a cath lab. And so I did. And that it was February 8th. So I finished cardiac rehab. I went for my next appointment and she put me in a cath lab. And I'm looking at the screen and I'm like, what's that? Because now I know a little something, right? I was misdiagnosed before, but you won't get me twice. So now I've done some research and learned some things about heart disease. So I'm looking at the screen in the cath lab and I'm asking the interventionalist, what is that? And where is that? And why does that look like that? And he motions to the nurse and to the anesthetist, the anesthesiologist. I think it was a nurse anesthetist, but whoever was in there with us, he's like, knock her out. And when I wake up, the EP and a nurse who had been taking care of me on my 30-day stay, they were standing there over me. And I looked at him and I called his full name and I said, what are you doing here? And he said, they called me in. And I said, don't look at me like that. I'm not gonna die.
You're right.
Right? And he's like, well, it doesn't look
Well,
good. And they didn't want to tell me. So they called him in because he knew me. And he was like, your ejection fraction is 21%. And you have your apex is aneurysmal, and you have aneurysms all throughout your heart. So what I was seeing on the screen were aneurysms, and that's why I was saying, what is that? And what is that? And why does that look like that? And so he says, it doesn't look good. I said, I'm gonna be fine. And I said, oh, I had been waking up in the middle of the night every night. And I kept a notebook on the side of my bed. And I just would almost like taking dictation. It was as if heaven, God was speaking to me. And I kept writing in the notebook every night. You're about to be in a battle for your life, but if you believe me, you'll live. And so I said, I felt pretty confident that I was going to come through it. And so I said, no, I'm going to be fine. We just need to figure out the solution, what to do next. And that was that. They put me in the long-term care ward of the hospital, asked me if I wanted to go on a transplant list. And I said, no, I want to keep my factory parts. Even know where that came from, Craig. But I was like, no, I think I'm gonna keep my factory parts. But literally, no one wanted to touch me. I'd had a quadruple bypass now 8 months out, right? And all my grafts had shut down. I had aneurysms all throughout my heart. My apex was aneurysmal. My ejection fraction 21%. And so no one wants to touch me. And I'm in the hospital, like, let's get this show on the road. Right? When's my next surgery to fix this so I can get on with life? And they come in and were like, you need to call a family meeting. And they come in and they present their case. And the doctor had already given me a PowerPoint of my heart with all of the damage, all of the things wrong with it. And I looked at them and I looked at my family and I was like, I'm not dying. I'm going to come up with a solution. Something can be done. And so I started calling the surgeon and he wouldn't come back. He wouldn't answer my calls. He was part of the meeting, but he wouldn't return my calls. He wouldn't take my calls. And then I called several other centers, to try to get them to take my case. The top heart centers. While I'm in the hospital bed here, I'm calling other centers. I'm being proactive. Like,
No,
look.
you're being a patient advocate for yourself, and that's like
Yes.
a kind of the third message, which some patients not only need to be a part of the team, but being an advocate for themselves, right, to
You have
some
to
degrees.
advocate for
But
yourself.
my one thing I want to say though, what clinicians need to be aware of is not to be afraid of a patient that is advocating for themselves. I think sometimes people get a little not taken aback, but like you should recognize the patient one should have a right to advocate for themselves, right? And that should be a sign you how to help them advocate as well. So.
Exactly. Like patients, and I kept saying that to them. I have the most to lose. I have the biggest stake in this. I need to be a part of this decision process. I'm not just gonna lay here, and I'm not gonna take this lying down, although I'm literally lying down in a bed. I'm not gonna take this lying
In
down.
levity to the situation, but yes.
And so when no one would listen to me, after a couple of weeks of calling, and my re calls not being returned, and I called my general cardiologist and I said, "Look, no one is returning my calls, and I'm frustrated." And I said, "They're all everyone's afraid." And she said, "Well, don't you think that if everyone thinks it's a bad idea, maybe it's a bad idea?" I said, "I think you are all wrong, like they were in the beginning." I just dug my heels in. I was resolute. You're wrong, and I'm not willing to put my life in your hand, in your decision-making hands. Now, I need your hands to operate. But you're wrong. They were wrong before and they're wrong now. I said, "I know that I will come through this. I know that I'll survive. I just need someone who is willing." So I look up, I call a friend and I'm like, "I need my laptop." So I begin to research, types of cutting edge therapies that could remedy my situation. And I see some, and now I have a decision to make because no one, what can I do to get some people to listen to me? Because they're still not listening to me. I'm like, seriously, all this happened and no one listened to me back in the beginning. So that's how my heart got severely damaged. And here we are again. This is so bizarre to me, but okay. And I asked, I said, why does no one want to operate? And literally gave me a candid answer. You're gonna die and your family's gonna sue. I said, "Oh, you want to make this a value proposition? Well, now you're in my wheelhouse because my degrees are in economics and finance, and I have an MBA." Okay. We're gonna make this about the bottom line. I know how to bottom line it. I called my friend. I said, "Bring me some makeup and some stuff to do my hair. I already had my laptop." I called a reporter and got myself on the front page of the weekend edition of the newspaper. And the article began, "She'd rather be in her size six bikini. Instead, she's laying in a hospital bed fighting for her life." That Monday, the administrators had seen the newspaper over the weekend. "Oh my God, what is happening in my hospital? Why are press conferences being held in my hospital? And why are you not operating on her?" And they were a little livid, but probably also admiring my moxie. They came back to me and said, "We'll take another look at you. And if you pass this threshold of tests, we'll operate." Because now I'm in the media. So
Right.
I just felt like I had no other alternative. If I die, I'm gonna die trying, and the world
Yeah.
will know. And that bottom line that you were so concerned about will plummet to the depths because I'm gonna make this you a household name and not in a good way. And so they came back and said, we'll take another look at you. If you pass these tests, we'll operate. Well, it was a fixed fight because, of course, I was going to pass the test. So they did the test. I passed the test and I had a repeat bypass. I had surgical ventricular reduction. So they remodeled my apex, which was ballooning out. And I had transmyocardial revascularization. And at the time, it was thought that collateral growth would happen if they drilled 15 laser holes in my heart. That you could do up to 40. They did 15 in hopes of getting collateral growth. Well, so I had the surgery. I came through. I was doing okay. But they were trying to rush me out, and you gotta go. You need to get up and get walking. And I said, look, I'm not ready yet, but I will get up and get moving. And so then, I got up, I walked, I was doing the things, but I was like, something is still wrong. Now I've had the second bypass, and it was a successful surgery, but I was like, something, I don't feel right. Something is still wrong. And, literally, we're like, well, you've got to go because you've been here too long. Your insurance is about to run. I'm not leaving.
Right.
And they're like, well, we're going to disconnect you. They literally disconnected me from all of the monitors. And this is like a week out from my surgery. But I said, I can't go because something is still wrong. And
Right.
I was disconnected from the monitors. No one checked on me. I called my general cardiologist again, and I said, something is still wrong, and they're trying to kick me out. I refuse to leave, because something is wrong. And she's like, I'm gonna put in an order for an echo, and I'll be up there in the morning. And they took me down, did an echo. I had a tamponade back into surgery for a pericardial window. So, third open heart.
Wow.
And then
You are amazing. Can I tell you, your journey is incredible, and not in a incredible is not the right word, because it's just,
it is because
yeah, but I mean, but you are amazingly, you're just been blessed, geez, not blessed in a good way, like blessed. You just, the fact that you get to be here and tell this story is so important, because it has so many things to it that people need to be aware of, right? And that's why you get to be an advocate, or you're a great advocate. So,
it
but.
does, right, because no one lives through that. I can't tell you how many people I've met during my journey who were far less sick than me, who are not here.
Right.
And so I know. And incredible because it's hard to believe.
And no, it's
And if I didn't live it and someone were telling me that, I'd be like, are you sure all of that happened?
And I believe you. That's not
No,
this
I'm
isn't
saying I
a
have the
story of
medical
belief.
records
It
to
is
prove
just
it.
it is
So
like it is just wild, right? And I don't
it
mean,
is.
yeah.
It is. That's an apt description. This is so wild. It is.
Yeah.
And it's my life. And I think that sometimes I literally say that out loud, like, this is so wild. And so then I had the third open heart. I had a pericardial window. And then after that, I was like, okay, now I feel better. I can
Right.
leave, you know?
Oh,
But
bless.
I just was not, I was so unwilling to be tossed aside. And, I don't, it just rose up in me. A lot of people go home based on the doctor's recommendation. And then, and they don't make it. And not that it's the doctor's intention that they don't make it, but they believe the patient's at a safe point. And the patient's like, okay, but they feel a little something, but they're afraid to speak up. But I just was like, no, I'm not leaving. You're not kicking me
Right.
out of here. I know my body, and I know if I leave here, it won't end well for me. No.
Right.
And it was very frustrating for them. The nurses were like, well, what are we supposed to do? I don't know what you need to do, but whatever it is, you need to call someone and tell them that I need more attention.
Right. Like I'm still Rhonda, the expert of Rhonda is still feeling issues with Rhonda, right? Like
Exactly,
like
literally.
so
Literally. And people think that's so funny that I refer to myself in
No,
third.
but I mean to be
No, I
fair,
mean in
you
third person. I do
yeah.
that sometimes in meetings, and people they chuckle. Like, did you just refer to yourself in third person? Yes. Because sometimes I have to take me out of it and be very matter of fact rather than get emotional, right?
Right.
A lot of times people get angry or get in there, get emotional, and then it doesn't come across as effectively as it needs to.
Sure.
And so I do. Sometimes I'll just, what would I say to someone else about this situation? But I'm saying it about myself, but
Sure.
because I need you to hear me, and I don't want you to be dissuaded by my emotion and what you see. And so because you need to we need to stick to the facts, and the fact is that something is wrong.
Right. So is that what is next on your journey?
Oh my gosh. So while I was in a hospital, so I'll tell you a little bit about my advocacy journey, but my health journey got relatively stable from there. And of course, it has not been smooth sailing, but that was the last major surgery. I've had a couple additional stents because I was stented in between the first and the second open heart surgery. They tried stents initially, and that didn't help for to revascularize me, and so then ultimately went to the second surgery. We just talked about the third, the pericardial window, and then I was pretty, relatively stable. Some minor hiccups until maybe 2011. I was in the when in the cath lab was having issues. And flatlined on the table, and my
Oh my
device
God.
delivered therapy and brought me back.
This is so
When
wow.
I woke up, when I came back to the interventionalist, and his nickname actually was Wild Bill, and it was wild. He said to me, "You scared the shit out of me."
No, oh, wow. He was very transparent.
He was because he just had never experienced anything like that. And I literally flatlined on the table, my ICD delivered therapy and brought me back. And so that was probably the last major thing last fall in cardiac rehab. I went through cardiac rehab again last fall. Just was just having some issues, and he said, "Well, I think it would be good for you to go through cardiac rehab because they were brought on with exertion." So it's like, "Well, go to cardiac rehab, and then before you go full on exercising again." And I did that, and ended up in the hospital, and so I had some minor stuff going on. But I'm stable. I'm good.
Yeah.
I'm
Well, listen, I am it's amazing and blessed that you're here, and I'm glad you're not glad all this happened to you, but glad you can share this journey, because I think some of the points we talked about are very salient and poignant to point out to folks. Can I ask
exactly.
what you go ahead, sorry.
No, I'm saying exactly. One, you know you from a for from a patient perspective, you know you. And so listen to your body
Well, and
and
as clinicians, we need to listen to the patient, right? And not write anything off and be engaged. And again, back to health equity
exactly.
and being consistent and following and continuing to do better about getting, more representation in trials and things to that effect.
I mean, I'm saying that to even to the pharmacists who listen, their patients as well. And
Yeah, no,
sometimes.
that's one of my questions. Like, what is your relationship with your pharmacist like, and how have you, or across your journey, have you experienced, things with the pharmacist, and what was great about them? What do you wish the pharmacist thought differently about?
I've had the best pharmacists throughout my journey, obviously because I have such a complex and severe history. I've gotten to know my pharmacist because I take a lot of medication, obviously. And so they've all been I've had some really great pharmacists and really good relationships with them where I'll ask them questions. They get to know my heart history so that when something else comes up and I maybe need a medication and I'm getting prescribed it, I'll talk to them about that, and it maybe it's interaction, drug interaction with other medications. They've also been just a great resource in terms of, sometimes through the years I've struggled to pay for medication because
Sure.
obviously I was very sick and unable to work. And just in terms of being aware of the resources that are available out there, hey, let me try and run it through this way, or let me, they just are
Yeah.
been very
In terms of access, right? Like really
in
helping to
terms
provide
of
that access.
access, the
Yeah.
pharmacist has been instrumental, at various points throughout my journey. As I said, coming Memorial Day weekend was when I had the initial quadruple bypass, and we're a couple weeks away from that. And that it'll be 22 years. And so during these 22 years, they certainly have provided, wisdom for me. We just had great relationships. Like one of the things that especially in the beginning, you have very limited personal interaction just because you're exhausted, you're tired, you don't get to see a lot of people. And so the pharmacist is one person I could always count on seeing. And so you get to have that personal human touch as well.
Well, and I think about you, especially with all the things going on, and we don't have to get fully adept to this, and maybe this is a total conversation for another day with you. But I mean, right after your pregnancy, you're having an event, and even while you're breastfeeding and doing anything, you have to completely think differently about the regimens that you're going to give and how you're going to manage the patient through this. So it even adds a different layer of complexity to, and back to what we were just saying, not just they're continuing to look for better ways and data to manage women after pregnancy, because we do see these types of things with cardiac events, and what does that look like, and identifying that complete separate subpopulation, right? And so,
Exactly.
yeah.
Exactly. And the pharmacist was actually the person who said, "You're gonna have to stop nursing." It was them who said, "Hey, this medication, because I'm always asking, how is this gonna in fact affect my baby, my newborn?" And at some point they were like, "Yeah, this is safe, this is safe, this is not safe, you're gonna have to give it up." And so, having a pharmacist that you trust, and that is going to look out for your best interests, and just being able to have that conversation that, hey, have you gotten your flu shot? Hey, you need to because of your high risk, just and not even not pressure, but just friendly reminders. I'm saying, I've seen a lot of people coming in here in this area of sick, and are you taking care of yourself? Are you making sure you're protected? And so just really establishing that relationship with them. I would talk to them. Sometimes I would forget to refill my medicine if I was going, and I would get re ready to go on a trip. So I travel a lot, and I in the beginning, I said I'm a global advocate, and I was going out of the country, and I didn't have all of the medicines when I went to fill up my pill box, and I'm leaving, the next morning. It's the 11th hour, and I'm running to the pharmacy like, can you please? I need this. And they're like, you're out of refill. But because they knew me, they put in a request to the doctor and was like, how long is your trip? I can give you enough for the trip, and we'll wait till the doctor, sends the refill in. But just knowing me, knowing my history, knowing that I've been on this medication, and just having that relationship with the pharmacist is great because it saved me. On many occasions, I hate to say that because it makes me seem unprepared, but at least three times I've over the past two decades, I've miscalculated or didn't refill a prescription in time and ended up needing them to help me out, and they did.
That's awesome. I'm sure we could talk to you all day long. Your journey is amazing, and maybe we bring you back. And just real quick, you're clearly with HeartLife, and what is your role with them?
Exactly. I was gonna say we missed all of that.
Yeah.
So I met Mark in 2018 in Frankfurt, Germany. Because prior to joining HeartLife, I've done a lot of advocacy through the years. It began, I think the first advocacy thing I did, the doctor who was standing over me when I woke up from that fateful cath where they told me I wasn't going to make it. My EF was 21%. He used to work at University of Michigan, and he said, we have a conference every year, and I'm going to get them to bring you in as a speaker. I'd never done anything like this, but he saw something in me, and that was my first advocacy gig, if you will. And I
Sure.
got a standing ovation and people lined up waiting to talk to me. And after that, in that line, a lady introduced herself and she said, do you know this woman and this organization called Women Heart? And I didn't know them, but she put me in touch and I joined them. And I went and met the CEO of the organization. And a couple months later, she called me and said, hey, the Today Show is looking for someone. Would you be willing to do it? And so I went on the Today Show. And then I worked with them for, gosh, 12 years and ended up joining the board. I was a Women Heart Champion, a legislative advocate, joined the board. It was ultimately elected chair. And then in 2018, I stopped and I started an organization called Boost, Better Outcomes, Optimal Scientific Therapies, because in my past life, I was an economist and a researcher and a research analyst. And so I kind of missed that. And I thought that research and regulatory science would be a good place for me to fulfill that kind of itch that I had. And so Boost was born. And one of my first gigs was in Frankfurt, Germany for Boehringer Ingelheim, brought me over and asked me to lead a global advisory board. And I did that. And I met Mark Baines there, who is a co-founder of HeartLife. And so we had worked together on that for the next 2 years, I want to say. Actually, it was probably longer than that. That was like 2018. And SGLT2 inhibitors became the fourth pillar of heart failure in 2022. So we worked on many projects along that journey to get SGLT2 to be the fourth pillar of heart failure care of GDMT. And So we just had a relationship, and I would see him, and then I met his co-founder Jillian in DC at CVCT, Cardiovascular Clinical Trialists Forum, and we just maintained a relationship. And so last year they approached me. They both called, and we had a meeting and asked if I would join the HeartLife team. They were wanting to expand into the US. You know, they're in Canada, they're a Canadian-based foundation charity, and they wanted to expand their work into the US because US clinics and organizations had reached out to them. And so they reached out to me and they were like, "We want to come to the US, and you were the first person we thought of." And so I lead their US efforts, the HeartLife US efforts in the US.
That's
Well,
awesome. And just, and you know, Mark and I are been talking, we're trying to get help, get resources into our local clinics and health systems and do some partnership to continue that expansion with you as well. So I'm excited to, you know, I'm trying to get, we're working on Pharmacy Times to be engaged with HeartLife and everyone. So hopefully stuff in the future. So Rhonda, this has been amazing. And I know we can continue to talk, but I want to be cognizant of your time. So my last question I normally ask my guests, is there any good books, movies, podcasts, music you're listening to, something you'd recommend?
Oh my gosh, what is the next? If there's a book I want to read, there's one. What's on my stand right now? I have two books on my stand right now. The one I'll mention to you is a very old book. And it's How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Okay, yeah, that's a good classic one that a lot of people should have in their domain or have had. Yeah, absolutely. That's a great book.
And when I was buying the book, the person said, "I don't think you need this book." I said,
Oh yeah, you're very sociable, right? Yes.
I said, "But we can always learn. You know, we can always
And
improve."
that's always should be the mentality. Always be learning and be opening to learning and never just accept as we are, right?
And then
So.
the podcast that I like NPR, and so I like The Moth. Have you ever listened to
Oh, I've not. I've seen it. I need to listen to it. I listen to a lot of the other NPR podcasts, but
I listen
so.
to a lot of others too, but
Yeah. Okay, well, I'll
I
check
like
that
The
one
Moth.
out and touch base with you on it.
All right.
Well,
Well,
thank you so much for your time today. And this has been amazing. And, you know, obviously, if people want to reach out to Rhonda, how would they find you if they wanted to hear more about your story or be engaged with you?
the easiest way to reach me is by email, by Gmail, and it's Rhonda E. Monroe at gmail.com, RhondaE Monroe at gmail.com.
Awesome. Rhonda, thank you so much for sharing your story and your journey and a lot of salient points and how the pharmacists have been engaged. And maybe hopefully I can bring you and Mark back as we start working on some more things. So I really appreciate you taking the time. So
I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
thank you so much. Have a good one. Thank you, everyone. If you want to continue to like and subscribe to the podcast, please let us know. You know, provide us feedback. We would love to have it. Rate our podcasts, give us feedback as always. And thank you, and see you on the next episode.